listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past Friday, the United Nations Security Council considered at a special meeting called in New York by the United States the question of protests in the Islamic Republic of Iran that have developed over the past couple of weeks. Although sound bites of the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations have made the airwaves in the U.S., the statements by the representatives from China and Russia, two permanent members of the Security Council, and Iran, the subject matter of the Security Council's discussion, have not been widely circulated, and so we bring you those here. First, these are the comments of China's Deputy Permanent Representative, Wu Haitao.
Mr. President, today's agenda is the situation of the Middle East. I wish to express China's principal position on this agenda. Recent developments in certain parts of the Middle East are worrying. Some countries are going through wars and conflicts. Hotspot issues are complicated, intertwined, and influence one another. Terrorist forces are rampant and spreading, all of which pose serious challenges on international peace and security. China hopes that countries of the region will work consistently with the international community to improve the situation in the Middle East as quickly as possible, and seek a fundamental solution to achieve regional peace, stability, and development. First, we call for a political solution to the hotspot issues in the region. All sides should play constructive roles and persistently promote dialogue and consultation, and reach a sustained solution that takes into account interests of all parties. Second, we should resolutely combat terrorism, persisting uniform standards, and employ all kinds of means to eliminate the root causes that breed terrorism. Third, the purpose and principles of the UN Charter and other basic rules governing all that govern international relations should be respected, and independent sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries of the region should be respected. Fourthly, countries of the region should be encouraged to strengthen dialogue, deepen understanding and trust. The Palestinian issue is the core of the Middle East issue. The international community should adhere to the two-state solution and work to restart the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and achieve a comprehensive, just, and sustained solution to the Palestinian issue at an earlier date. The international community should persist in a political solution to the Syrian issue as the main direction, continue to count on the UN as the main channel of mediation, and work towards the comprehensive, just, and careful resolution of the Syrian issue as early as possible. Mr. President, according to the UN Charter, the Council's primary responsibility is maintaining international peace and security. Therefore, the Security Council should not discuss the internal affairs of any country, nor is it the venue for discussing the human rights issue of any country. China takes note of the recent domestic developments of Iran. China hopes and trusts that with the efforts of the Iranian government and people, Iran will remain stable and achieve development. The Iranian situation does not pose any threat on international peace or security, nor is it on the agenda of the Security Council. Discussing the domestic situation of Iran by the Council is a practice that is not in line with the Council's responsibilities as outlined in the UN Charter. Doing so, it does not help resolve the domestic issue of Iran. Thank you, Mr. President.
Ambassador Wu's comments were followed by those of the permanent representative from the Russian Federation, Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia.
Why is the United States, a permanent member of the Security Council and one of the authors of the UN Charter, undermining the authority of the Security Council as the main body which is responsible for maintaining international peace and security? I mean, I think it is obvious for everyone that the topic chosen today does not fall within the prerogatives established by the UN Charter for this Security Council. And the references we hear today to Article 34 of the UN Charter as it applicable to this situation are completely inappropriate. This should be obvious to anyone who will take the time to read Article 34 of the Charter once again. We have often drawn attention to the fact that it is unacceptable to use bogus pretexts to include in the agenda purely internal political affair issues. Why has the United States chosen to do this today when the domestic situation in Iran has become normalized? And by the way, we should thank Washington for this because to a large extent it's thanks to its dynamic words of encouragement and messages to the Iranian people that we witnessed a consolidation of the Iranian society and they were united by anti-American feelings. The feeling is that there's some sort of inexplicable allergy to this country and that it clouds the thinking about events in this country and leads to wishful thinking. We obviously regret the loss of lives as a result of demonstrations that weren't so peaceful. However, let Iran deal with its own problems, especially since this is precisely what is taking place. You are dispersing the energy of the Security Council instead of focusing it on dealing with acute crisis situations in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Yemen, DPRK on the African continent. Instead of that, you are proposing that we interfere in the internal affairs of a state. And we don't want to be involved in destabilizing Iran or any other country. Instead of that, let's have a substantive discussion on the issue of the Middle East peace process, including the Palestinian question. If we follow your logic, then we should have meetings of the Security Council after the events in Ferguson and Missouri, or after the dispersal by force of the Occupy Wall Street movement in Manhattan. Or maybe we should propose having a Security Council meeting when a wave of demonstrations occurs in some Western country. Mr. President, we shouldn't look far into history to offer many examples of what short-sighted moves accompanied with interference in internal affairs lead to, or attempts to replace undesirable regimes or impose recipes of democracy. Unfortunately, due to various violations and neglect of the founding principles of the charter, such as independence and sovereign equality of states, a non-interference in internal affairs, peaceful resolution of disputes. Because of that, the situation in many countries of the Middle East that were stable until recently has become horrible. The occupation of Iraq under openly false pretexts, which is still being heavily felt by the people of this country. The gross manipulation of the mandate of the Security Council that led to chaos and destruction in Libya. The methodological incitement and fanning the flames of internecine warfare in Syria and flirting with terrorists. The war in Yemen, all these open wounds will continue to remind us of the destructiveness of geopolitical engineering and the attempts to determine the fates of other states and nations. However, people prefer not to mention this, not to remember this, and when we remind them of this, they pretend that it doesn't concern them. Sometimes we're asked why we're wary about the concept of the prevention of violent extremism. Well, the approach of the American delegation to what is taking place in Iran is an excellent example to illustrate the substance of our concerns. The source of the problem is declared to be suppression of peaceful protests, the cruelty and undemocratic nature of the regime. And there's a parallel drawn to the events in Syria in 2011. There, a threat to international peace and security is declared. Thus, the need for external interference is justified in the affairs of Iran. This is precisely the kind of approach that is involved in the notion that is being promoted by the United States of violent extremism. And yet, it is precisely incitement from outside and calls on so-called changes could lead to radicalization and violence, whether it's in Iran or any other country. Mr. President, the real reason for convening today's meeting is not an attempt to protect human rights or promote the interests of the Iranian people, but rather as a veiled attempt to use the current moment to continue to undermine the joint comprehensive plan of action. Similar assessments of the situation were expressed in Berlin and in Paris just yesterday. We consider it unacceptable to intentionally undermine the support of the international community for the JCPOA, which is the main achievement in nuclear non-proliferation over the past few years and in international efforts to ensure international and regional security, especially in a situation where the IAEA has continually confirmed full compliance by Iran with its obligations. Instead of that, the United States has continued to introduce unilateral restrictions that are in breach of international law. And we keep wondering, do you have any other means, diplomatic means, other than sanctions at your disposal? Instead of trying to involve the Security Council in internal affairs and interference in internal affairs, the Council should actually support useful initiatives in establishing regional dialogue on security issues. In the framework of that dialogue, we can find solutions to many issues and concerns. Russia has put forward an initiative on establishing confidence-building measures in the Persian Gulf region. Provision of the Resolution 598 from 1987 continues to be unimplemented. This provision instructs the Secretary General to develop, in consultation with regional parties, security and confidence-building measures. It would be useful to draw it to pay attention to the ideas of the Secretary General, to launch a process of political dialogue to resolve existing differences among key countries of the region. Mr. President, we would like to believe that we won't have meetings such as this one under your presidency or in subsequent presidencies, and that the Council will start working on the issues that the UN Charter has defined for it. Thank you very much.
The session was closed with the following comments from Iran's permanent representative, Ambassador Gholam Ali Khosrou.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Mr. President, the move by the United States to bring to this council protests in Iran by some of our citizens for legitimate grievances, some exacerbated by none other than U.S. itself in its dereliction of its obligation under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is an abuse of its power as a permanent member and an abuse of the Council itself. It is unfortunate that despite the resistance on the part of some of its members, this Council has allowed itself to be abused by the current U.S. administration in holding a meeting on an issue that falls outside the scope of its mandate, putting on display the failure of the Council to fulfill its real responsibility in maintaining international peace and security. It is a discredit for the Security Council to take up a matter that is of a pure domestic nature while failing abjectly to lift a finger when it comes to genuine issues such as the long-lasting occupation of Palestinian territory, to which this item is dedicated, and the indiscriminate bombing of Yemen in the past 3 years, which has so far resulted in the deaths of thousands of human lives, human beings, and has brought hunger, disease, and destruction on the Yemeni people. The list of such failures of the Council are all attributable to the obstructionist approach by the U.S. delegation, and goes on and on. Mr. President, this is nothing but another desperate attempt by the U.S. administration to escape forward, as it has lost every shred of moral, political, and legal authority and credibility in the eyes of the whole world. Following such acts of disruption taken by this U.S. administration as flouting international law and disrespecting the practices of civilized behavior in international politics, this administration is now desperately reaching for every straw that keeps it afloat. There is a long history of U.S. bullying at the U.N., but this is a preposterous example. The purely internal affairs of a nation, in this case, protests that the Iranian government has addressed with the utmost respect for the rights of the protesters and with every attempt to deal with peacefully, despite violent infiltrators and direct encouragement by foreign forces, including by the President of the United States, is not the subject of debate by the world's most important security organ. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, for those who may not remember, also the United States' long history of intervention in the internal affairs of Iran. A continuous pattern of disruption in the course of the democratization process in Iran can be traced back to the coup staged by the U.S. against Iran's democratically elected prime minister in 1953. Hostile acts intensified once Iranian rose up to overthrow their dictator ruler, who was unsurprisingly loved by the U.S. government. Since then, among others, the U.S. has backed attempted military coup and acts of sabotage in Iran, imposed illegal and inhuman unilateral sanctions against ordinary Iranians, unconditionally supported Saddam Hussein in his 8-year destructive war against Iranians, including by providing him with chemical weapons and even directly engage in military confrontation with Iran in defense of Saddam. I should also refer to the 290 innocent lives lost, including 66 children, on board Iran Air 655 shot down in July 1988 by the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf. It would be a remiss of me not to recall that the U.S. shamelessly decorated the commander who gave the order to fire. Mr. President, while President Trump may be enamored of the fact that no protesters demonstrated against his presence while he was in our neighborhood a few months ago, he may be unaware that they have no right to protest. The fact is that this every democratic country citizens will from time to time take to streets to protest one thing or another, and Iran is no exception. In every country, the security forces, be they police, national guards, or others, are present to ensure that protests remain peaceful, and Iran is again no exception. However, while the U.S. accuses Iran of suppressing protests, one can only gasp at the hypocrisy when viewing images of Occupy Wall Street protesters beaten and dragged by American policemen. And to go back in time, when National Guardsmen fired on and killed peaceful student protesters at Kent State University, or to watching film of the protests outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968. Or more recently, we can review to the 1992 Los Angeles riots over the brutal beating of Rodney King by policemen and killings of innocent African American at the hands of law enforcement continue unabated, as we all know. When the California Army National Guards, the 7th Infantry Division, and the 1st Marine Division were called in to restore order, a total of 63 people were killed during the uprising, 2,383 were injured, and more than 12,000 were arrested. I don't recall any member of the UN Security Council calling for debate on this issue when the U.S. military was involved in suppressing domestic unrest. Nor was there debate in 1993 when the FBI raided the Branch Davidian headquarters in Waco, Texas, after a 51-day standoff killing 83 men, women, and children, the vast majority of whom were entirely innocent of any crime. It was behoove of U.S. ambassador, who perhaps was busy with other priorities at the time of their occurrence, to read up on these travesties of justice on American soil before condemning others for far less. But it is not just the U.S. that has an unviable record in dealing with protesters. In 2005 in France, then Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy declared a zero-tolerance policy toward protests emanating from the deprived suburbs of Paris, and other major French cities, referring to demonstrators, largely poor immigrants, as a scum. With almost 3,000 arrests and several deaths, the unrest was only quelled to reemerge in multiple other forms, more recently in 2017, when the police rape of a young French citizen of African origin once again triggered protests. I do not, however, recall the UN Security Council being summoned for debate on this. And in 2011, in the United Kingdom, the Home Secretary, Theresa May, utterly condemned the violence amid protests in her country, saying such disregard for public safety and property will not be tolerated. Meanwhile, Prime Minister David Cameron warned rioters, "You will feel the full force of the law, and if you are old enough to commit these crimes, you are old enough to face punishment." In the span of merely a few days, some 3,100 arrests were made, and with the authorities told that they could ignore existing sentencing guidelines, two young men who promoted riots via Facebook with the proposed disturbances not attended by any other people were handed 4-year sentences. I do not recall any country bringing any of these reactions to protest across the self-described civilized democracies to the attention of, let alone opening to debate at the United Nations Security Council. Mr. President, we have hard evidence of the violence in Iran by a handful of the protesters, in some cases resulting in the deaths of policemen and security officers, being very clearly directed from abroad. This violent element surfaced in the crowd as early as Friday evening last week, at the inception of the protest. At that point, the hands of elements from outside Iran, including instigators based in the United States and Europe, began to be visible. Incitement to violence included encouraging and training people to use Molotov cocktails, to siege ammunition depots, and to stage an armed uprising. One U.S. resident took to social media to order the killing of 120 members of our security forces, threatening that those who will be included among the killed are their families, too, in their homes. This same U.S. resident publicly stated to U.S. media with complete sense of impunity that they should burn down government mosques and police stations. It was clear enough to not just us, but also third parties, that Telegram messengers executive decided to block some of the violent inciting channels, citing a line one shouldn't cross. All of this is also well documented in the mainstream media. In one case, a man with extensive criminal record captured a fire engine and ran it over a car, murdering the driver and his 12-year-old son. In some other cases, hooligans got involved and looted shops and banks. Altogether, the peaceful, legitimate protests, which my government emphatically confirmed are a constitutional right which has been respected since the Islamic Revolution, were abused and hijacked to stage vandalism, hooliganism, and in several cases, the firing of weapons. President Trump and some other U.S. politicians have joined ISIS and its patrons in our region to openly incite and encourage violence. It is the ultimate irony that the country whose head of state has thrown his lot in with those visiting violence and destruction on Iran has its UN ambassador, who has a history of belligerent comments on my country, bring it as an issue for debate on the Security Council. If anything, it is Iran that should be demanding a debate and investigation into how and why foreign elements with impunity are allowed to encourage and support unrest and violence in another sovereign and founding member of the United Nations. For example, let's debate why the United States has failed, in spite of repeated official requests, to stop the incitement to violence and murder of innocent civilians from its territory? Or why some European countries continue to provide safe haven to terrorists who are inciting violence and armed rioting as we speak? Why social media sites that promote and teach the use of Molotov cocktail and boast about people using arms to kill in Iran operate freely in their territory in spite clear evidence? There are the real issues that need to be addressed. Distinguished members, to make this farce into something more than a mere waste of time, let us discuss something else that this council has not, but should deal with. The free flow of information has brought with it the spread of fake news and other forms of information war. These threats are common to all free and sovereign nations. We are not alone in finding it necessary to formulate solutions to these challenges. Recently, French President Macron also lauded efforts to increase transparency about the ownership of websites, including their foreign funding, further empowerment of government agencies to fight against any attempt to destabilization by TV station, control or influence by foreign states, and also suggested countering social media channels used as propaganda by introducing laws to disclose the source of funding for particularly sponsored content. These measures are not needed to simply fight back against fake news, rioters, and electoral interference, but more ominously in the fight against terrorists, including ISIS. This fight, distinguished members and colleagues, is not zero sum. We will either win together or lose together. Thank you, Mr. President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's a new year, but the same stories persist. Out front is the chaotic Trump White House, followed by the Steele dossier and a possible breakthrough with North Korea. Crosstalking the new year, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. Okay, gentlemen, as always, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's talk about Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. I look at it as basically political gossip, something that some things in there we've already suspected. But one of the things I thought was interesting that I pulled from the excerpts, I haven't read the book, I haven't seen the whole thing, but you know, when we have these conversations with Steve Bannon, the former strategist, and being thrown to the curb later by Mr. Trump, the collusion with Israel, again, the story pops up. It doesn't get a whole lot of coverage because people want to hyperventilate about how crude or rude or simple-minded or stupid the president is. But there are little nuggets coming out here that the mainstream just isn't interested in. Dima.
Well, first I was puzzled by the admission of Michael Wolff that actually, I'm going to quote him, certain segments of the early days of Trump's presidency in this book were false. And I urge readers to make up their own minds.
Well, that's not journalism. Mark, what was your reaction to it? I don't want to waste a lot of time on gossip. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he specifically said that a lot of what he says in the book, quotations and so on, contradicts each other. And that some of the people were flat out lying to him. And that in some areas he's going to let the readers decide what is true. In other areas, he's going to decide on a narrative that he believes in. This guy is a charlatan. He's a flim-flam man. He's selling scandal to an audience, a resistance liberal media audience.
They want scandal.
They want this to believe. It's like Fox Mulder. I want to believe. Now, this is a review of one of his earlier books in the New Republic, hardly a center-left magazine. Much to the annoyance of Wolf's critics, the scenes in his columns aren't recreated so much as created, springing from Wolf's imagination rather from actual knowledge of events. Even Wolf acknowledges that conventional reporting isn't his bag. Rather, he absorbs the atmosphere and gossip surrounding him at cocktail parties, on the street, and especially during those long lunches at Michael's. He's around town enough to have those insights, to spot people, to come across pieces of information. He also has a talent for making the most of even the briefest encounters. His great gift is the appearance of intimate access.
Okay, so yeah, I think we got we've got the flavor of it here.
Yes,
the reactions to the book, the excerpts that people are talking about, I think is also really interesting, is that maybe what is different in this year, we started last year where everyone is an expert on all things related to Russia, which virtually none of them are experts. They hardly learned anything about Russia through the course of 2017. But in 2018 is now the mainstream media. They're all psychologists, okay, that they can judge the mental health of the president of the United States. Again, the Russia scandal story is fizzling out. We'll talk about that later in the program. And now it's the president's mental health. That's the news story.
Well, I think there are, of course, questions about Trump's behavior, even though I think that the fact that he abandoned TPP and TTIP, this will be on the good side of his presidency, as well as the fact that even skeptics admitted he did more for bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States than the last five presidents. We have to admit it.
Yeah, but you're talking about facts.
I'm talking about facts.
But see, this is the media doesn't talk
Absolutely.
About facts. This is what the problem
but of
is
course
here.
He's,
is it, Mark? This is what I'm getting at here: is that they don't want to look at facts. They want to look. They want their narrative to become prevalent, and they reinforce it 24/7.
Peter, this is the time once again for the time-honored tradition of American partisan political dysfunction, where the side that lost the election starts accusing the side that won the election, be that the president, being that the people that elected him, of being crazy. There's nothing new here. Every president since Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, they have all had their question, their sanity, their mental health questioned in the mainstream media.
But to this degree, it has never happened
no,
here. And I think what's really interesting here, in a much broader sense, is that this whole idea of a loyal opposition is disappearing. It's disappearing in the neoliberal world. And that is a huge threat to the system, because if I dislike you, then you lack morality. So it's not that we disagree. It's that you're evil. And this is, having a loyal opposition is the key, the foundation to political stability in the West. It has been for a millennia.
Well,
that's disappearing.
That's degradation of institutions. That's, I'm sorry, it's a destruction of democracy. Because I remember very well, despite all the differences between, say, Bush the senior and Clinton, when Clinton won the election, Bush said, now we will all stand behind the president. And that was normal.
But that's not happening now.
I can't even imagine Obama saying that. And when he said something similar in the first 3 or 4 days after the election, everyone understood he is going to say different things in a few days.
We know from the election to inauguration, the Obama administration did everything in their power to trip
Absolutely.
Up the incoming president. Let's change gears. Let's talk about North Korea. Mark, an interesting set of events occurring here. The North and the South are going to start some kind of engagement here. It looks like the Russian-Chinese plan for freeze for freeze. The North Koreans would halt their program if the United States and South Korea would stop maneuvers in the South. So did Trump win this one, or is he being outwitted? Go ahead.
I think he's just being ignored and maneuvered around. The North Korean government has what it wants. it now has a nuclear deterrent, which the U.S. has given every indication that despite all the rhetoric and bluster coming out of the White House, the defense secretary, and Trump's tweets, of course, that it is not willing to sacrifice millions of South Koreans to prevent North Korea from having a nuclear deterrent. So now North Korea and South Korea are now actually starting to sit down and talk directly to each other rather than the hub and spoke type relationship of foreign policy. U.S. would prefer that South Korea only do what it says with regards to North Korea.
Well, one of the interesting things here, Dima, is that, you know, you won't get this in mainstream media, but the South Koreans are reminding everyone that they're a sovereign state and they have the right to determine their foreign policy.
I think they're reminding themselves of that fact.
Absolutely. True. But, you know, if you look at Western media coverage and the politicos in Washington, they're quite bewildered by this because it's the South Koreans taking the initiative. Oh, my goodness, they have historical agency. Who knew?
Go ahead. It's true. But how did the whole story begin? South Koreans just indicated that they had a letter, they had a message from North Koreans suggesting to reestablish connection, you know, fax connection, electronic connection. So basically, South Koreans did what the North Koreans asked the Americans to do. They started talking. They at least checked the fax machine. And that already made things a lot better. Now, North Korean athletes, North Korean team, may go to Pyeongchang for the Olympic Games. Unfortunately, the Russian Olympic team will not be allowed to do that. It shows you how absurd the modern world has become. But if you look at the history of the problem, I think the South Korean story is very important. It's very important what you mentioned. South Korea was allowed to become rich in the 70s and 80s by the United States as a deterrent against North Korea, against China, against the Soviet Union. No new countries after South Korea were allowed to become rich, even when they became satellites of the United States.
Ukraine should remember it. They had preferential trading relations with the United States to get
the South Koreans into a powerhouse. The Americans would not allow the copyright to be breached. It's really interesting for me.
You know, I mentioned that the Russian-Chinese idea, and then you have South Korea and you have North Korea. It's going back to what it should have been all along, a regional problem resolved by the countries in the region, not an outsider determining what South Korea's foreign policy and defense policies would be.
Should be, yeah.
It needs to be pointed out that both Russia and China both have good relations with both of these countries, more or less, right? And that all four of these countries stand to benefit primarily economically from improved relations between North and South Korea. Russia would like to supply energy to South Korea. They want a transport corridor through North Korea, providing South Korea access directly through Russia to European markets. There is every potential here if they manage to push the U.S. with its big button out of the way, that there could be a real breakthrough. You know, we have to start with baby steps, of course, in relations between North and South Korea, brokered by Russia and China, which both stand to benefit from reunification. An eventual reunification, unlike the United States. When you look at the four players here,
what's being initiated, and we've seen, you know, false starts before, but everybody, the four countries, they're basically going to get everything they want. Well, that's really quite remarkable because it's done through diplomacy.
Well, we had a similar story with Syria. Ultimately, who is now resolving the problem? Why is the fighting dying down little by little? Iran, Russia, basically Turkey, and to a lesser extent Lebanon. Okay, so the countries that are close to Syria, that have an interest in Syria being peaceful, they are of course much more capable of bringing peace to that region than the outsiders. I think sooner or later Ukrainians will understand that this is the same. After that short break,
we'll continue our discussion on stories in the new year. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's move on to the United Nations and Iran. We know that at the end of 2017, in the beginning part of this year, there were a number of protests in Iran, and we saw a flurry of particularly congressional officials and, of course, the media get all excited about the possibility of giving freedom to the Iranian people. they didn't really understand the story. These were economic protests, and when push came to shove, there were a lot more pro-government protests going out in supporting of the government here. Then you had the humiliation of the United States again in the Security Council, when most of the permanent members saying, what are we doing here? Why are we here? It's an internal problem for Iran to resolve. The United States, again, standing completely alone. Of course, the Iranians were claiming there's some kind of colored revolution that was in the works. We've seen this playbook before. But it's very interesting, the isolation of the United States when it comes to Iran. This is a complete fail for Washington and the Trump administration, particularly Nikki Haley. She has no friends there, apparently, anymore. Go ahead.
There is a political scientist in the United States whom I like a lot, Michael Brenner. He basically wrote on this. We live from obsession to obsession, from Russia to China, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, anyone who dares to cross Uncle Sam. But Iran is the longest obsession that has been going on for 38 years. Yeah. So when you are obsessed about something, you lose the ability to judge soundly what's going on there. Iran is a complicated country. There are different groups, basically, and some of these groups are demanding things which are quite contrary to what the United States wants. You know, there are conservatives in Iran who want the government to be more conservative than it is now. And the figures, okay, 12 people killed during the protests. There were days when the United States, by its drone attacks, killed more people in Pakistan or Yemen.
Well, the interesting thing here, Mark, is that when there were events going on in Ferguson, there was the Russians and the Chinese or the French or the British, they didn't call for the United Nations Security Council to convene because there were riots inside the United States. But the United States seems to think that it has the moral responsibility to protect protesters in Iran when they don't even protect their own people at home.
Go ahead. That's exactly what the Russian representative to the United Nations chastised Nikki Haley about. Should we then investigate Ferguson? Should we investigate Occupy Wall Street? Are these matters for international
peace? What happened with that shooting in Las Vegas? I'd like to know something about that. Maybe the UN can help us find out what happened in Vegas.
Put peacekeepers. In Ferguson, I think, would be a good idea. Now, these protests, they are completely, hasn't been a story since Russiagate. Well, I mean, there's so many of them stories, actually, that the press has gotten so wrong. And the press was baying, the press, the commentariat, the foreign policy blob in the U.S. were baying as one. Regime change, freedom,
well,
free
protests. Well, I mean,
protests.
The irony is, of course, is they wanted sanctions to force the Iranian people to change the regime. Sure. And now they're saying that they want to help the people of Iran. Completely contradictory. They don't even know what they said in the past.
I'm old enough to remember John McCain just a few years ago singing bomb, 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 bomb Iran. So tell me again how much the U.S. Figures and the OCONs in the U.S. government care about the people of Iran and their freedom. But these protests actually started outside of Tehran. This wasn't the green protests again. This isn't an urban middle class. These are working class poor in small cities in Iran that were angry about subsidies and benefits being removed by the popular moderate prime minister, just recently reelected in a landslide, Rouhani. There's some indication that they actually had the support of conservatives within the government, because this is seen as a neoliberal move to take these things away, and the conservatives are more economically left. But some people say these protests were then hijacked by violent armed rioters. Mm-hmm. Others say that there was actually some small parallel riots going on that were trying to do under the cover of the protests. But the government actually reacted fairly moderately, and Rouhani said the people have a right to protest as long as they're peaceful. I don't think this was the reaction that the U.S. wanted. I think they, of course, they had their color revolution figure in the game. Any suggestion that they weren't involved at some level in these riots is absurd.
But what it does say, Dima, is that Iran is on the agenda. It's on the menu for the deep state and their colleagues in Israel. They definitely want to see some kind of...
They don't make a secret right. out of it. And, of course, you know, just imagine what would happen if Russia reacted to Ferguson in the same way. I think these reports in Russia that Ferguson is a breach of human rights and it should be investigated, these reports would be looked upon, you know, under a microscope now by Mr. Mueller and others. How did they try to influence the political process in the United States?
That was actually part of the CIA assessment, their anger that RT dared to cover Occupy
and
Wall Street.
We did a great job in covering Matter. Ferguson. I'm very proud of RT. All right, let's change gears here. Russiagate still kind of moves along, though its parameters are thinning, I think, here. But one story that stays with us, and I think should have been at the very center of it, is the Fusion GPS Christopher Steele dossier. We have Republican congressional officials coming out saying they want an investigation of this. Parallel, we have new investigations into the Clinton Foundation, three of them, possibly four here. So both are fine, have a life of their own, Mark, here. But I really think this Fusion GPS thing is the key to it. This is the glue that has the entire Russiagate conspiracy theory. How's it pulls it all together? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a big, broad legal pushback. That's the story at the beginning of this year against Russiagate. Manafort is suing the FBI special investigator Mueller for stepping outside the boundaries of anything to do with the election, Trump, Russiagate, and going back and through his tax records from more than a decade ago. So he's calling for judicial review of the powers that Mueller has. We have the Clinton Foundation is now being investigated for corruption, for taking large sums of money from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries while the U.S. was arming these countries to the hilt. We have this investigations are being called for into both Christopher Steele, this former British spook for hire that was hired by the DNC and then later essentially picked up by the FBI. They were at least paying his expenses to create opposition research,
well,
this scandal sheet.
It's really interesting because I saw how the New York Times gave Fusion GPS a little bit of space to redeem themselves here in the article. It's January 2nd here. The Republicans' fake investigation by Glenn Simpson and Peter Frisch, I think that's how you pronounce his name. And here they say, in the year since the publication of the so-called Steele dossier, the collection of intelligence reports we commissioned about Donald Trump's ties to Russia. This is a fabrication. This is fake. Mm-hmm. This is fake. It wasn't a collection of intelligence reports. This is opposition research. Completely different, okay? Cool. And they're trying to pass it off as being the same thing, and you have the failing New York Times carrying water for Fusion GPS. This is a complete scam on many different levels.
Well, the New York Times has been so shameless in its campaign against Trump for over a year now, I think 2 years. It's impossible to read them because out of nine articles that I get in my mail, you know, out of nine, eight, I think, are anti-Trump, how Trump is bad. But I think there is an interesting point here. I think it's comical and at the same time tragic. Paul Manafort, they went after Paul Manafort. Manafort actually wanted to make Yanukovych a pro-American president of Ukraine. He wanted Yanukovych to turn against Russia after he comes to power. And for that, you know, they decided...
They really rewarded him.
To destroy him now. And Manafort got mad, obviously, so now he's suing, he's going to law against his detractors.
I don't usually look for virtue in politics. Manafort was making a lot of money, Dima, and so were the Podesta brothers and everybody else, okay? Mm-hmm. It's all about that. It's all about influence and money. So, you know, making him into a pro-American president, okay, maybe, depending on how much you would get paid. Go ahead, Mark.
I have to disagree with you, but I have no problem with the New York Times taking out hit piece after hit piece of Donald Trump, because there's a lot of domestic policies, environmental concerns that he frankly deserves it on. But what I do have a problem with is them pursuing against all reason, all evidence, this Russiagate scandal as the key
because George Papadopoulos got drunk with an Australian diplomat and spewed garbage to make himself look important.
A year later, there is no evidence of collusion. There isn't even any more evidence that Russia actually did anything to hack or interfere with the election. And still this witch hunt goes on. They keep generating more smoke. They're hoping to carry this whole partisan, Neil McCarthyite affair right into the midterm elections to give them both energy. And then if they manage to take back both houses, to jump right into partisan political impeachment.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so we've got 11 months to wait, huh, Mark?
Yeah. Just don't expect any actual evidence of collusion.
Look, we've already had over a year of spinning their wheels. Yeah. I mean, it's quite amazing that this the story continues to go on without any basis in fact. Right. Go ahead, Dean, before we go to the break.
Well, I think it's not just that story. You just repeat a certain assertion, and then people finally will start believing it. It was the same with the so-called McLaren report about Russian athletes using drugs. No proof whatsoever, not a shred of evidence. But since the Russians did not refute it, as the head of the International Olympic Committee now said, it must be true. In the same way, no shred of evidence of Russian collusion in the election. But since the Russians did not present proper evidence denying it, it must be true.
So negative evidence.
Okay, so proving a negative. This is remarkable.
It's against a very important legal rule.
That is a really good reflection on the media here. Okay, what you have to do is you're guilty and you have to prove your innocence.
Absolutely.
Okay? Exactly. Okay, gentlemen, that's all we have time for. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.